Tariffs are good or tariffs are bad. A primer today on unintended consequences. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Tuesday, September the 11th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. A curious thing seems to be happening in the American steel industry. Curious because, on the face of it, steel here is doing all right. Prices are up, production's up, company profits are up, some even much of that thanks to the Trump administration's 25% tariffs on imported steel. But be that as it may, steel workers aren't happy. The United Steelworkers Union contract with this country's two biggest producers, U.S. Steel and ArcelorMittal, expired on the 1st of September. Negotiations are happening. Steel is still coming off the line, to be sure. But union locals all over the country have voted to authorize a strike against U.S. Steel if the negotiations don't come through. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going with that one.
In its contract proposal, U.S. Steel has offered 3-4% raises in the first 3 years, then 1% for the next 3 years, plus bonuses linked to company performance. The union objects to backloading the contract with uncertain bonuses in later years and to higher worker health care costs. By the way, we reached out to the union and company for comment. They both directed us to their online bargaining updates. The union accepted big wage concessions when the company was struggling back in 2015, but U.S. Steel's not struggling now, says industry analyst John Tomazos.
The price of steel almost has doubled with the tariffs and a little stronger economy.
Demand for domestic steel has risen, workers have been hired, profits are up. Equity analyst Philip Gibbs at KeyBank Capital Markets says the union's argument is essentially,
we've got tariffs right now. The company's doing really well. They should share in that.
But he says the company's looking out for its shareholders and future profitability.
Pricing right now is probably about as good as it's going to get. The bottom line is they need more labor flexibility because if they go into a downturn, they need to make tough decisions and then also have variable pay.
If negotiations deadlock and the union strikes, Ned Hill at Ohio State says there's risk for U.S. Steel, which
we'll lose money if there's a shutdown because things are pretty good for them right now.
But there's an incentive on both sides to keep the mills open while the tariffs are in effect and profits are strong. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Mitchell was talking about how steelworkers are feeling, right? So let's pause here for a second to see how listeners and consumers are feeling and recap the current state of the trade war, shall we? NAFTA renegotiations picked up again this week. China is still threatening to impose tariffs on another $60 billion in American imports over there if the White House goes ahead with more taxes on Chinese goods coming here. The Department of Commerce has gotten more than 36,000 requests for steel tariff exemptions from U.S. companies. That is, American firms that say they gotta have the imported product because they can't get it here. Just 2,300 of those 36,000 have been approved, all of which, we get it, gets tough to keep track of. So we are going to do, as promised, a couple of listener questions. Here's Ray Levesque from Columbia, Maryland, about how the whole tariff logistics thing works.
I'm curious how they are collected and, you know, is it a tax or is it something that's going to some company along the way that helps them?
Katie Ruz teaches economics at the University of California, Davis. Let's say it all with her.
Tariffs are taxes. So tariff is a word to describe a specific type of tax levied on goods that we're importing from other countries.
And that tax bill, the tax payment, it goes to?
So if you're buying a good from a foreign country directly, then you're the importer of record in the U.S. Customs database, and technically the importer of record is charged the tariff. Sometimes you'll hear people say, oh, we're going to make foreigners pay tariffs when they sell us goods. But really, it's the importer of record who pays the tariffs.
Okay, now that that's clear, then what? That's what Helga Bure from Hyde Park, Massachusetts wanted to know.
With all the money that's supposed to be taken in with tariffs, I'm wondering where that money goes.
It's pretty straightforward, actually. Once companies pass those taxes on to consumers, the money goes where all the other tax money goes, into the U.S. Treasury. All told, as of August 28th, $3.5 billion in tariffs have been collected. That's according to the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. All right, so enough money and tariffs. What about jobs and whether they are actually coming back thanks to the tariffs? Mark Dirtsbaugh is from Gettysburg, Pennsylvania.
Will tariffs actually increase jobs and domestic manufacturing in the U.S.
And back we go to UC Davis economist Professor Katie Russ.
Tariffs may help some industries expand employment, especially industries selling directly to U.S. consumers. It is likely to hurt employment or reduce growth in employment in industries who compete with foreign producers in foreign markets. So U.S. companies who sell abroad, their employment, their hiring will be slowed or cut back.
Look, this all gets complicated. We get that. I said it before, which is why we made a website to help you keep track. Are we in a trade war.com, where we've got the answer to that question, are we in a trade war? And a whole bunch more questions. Also, a handy dandy timeline of who did what tariff to whom and when. On Wall Street today, up would be a word you could use. So we will when we do the numbers. Way far away from Wall Street, 450 miles as the crow flies, in point of fact, you'll find Kidron, Ohio. Far away in distance, also far away in mentality and lifestyle, deep in the heart of Amish country out there. But coincidences and history being what they are, a small town hardware store in Kidron has a connection to the landmark bank failure of the financial crisis. Today, for our project on the financial crisis, 10 years later, divided decade, we call it, Kidron, Ohio resident Galen Lehman, owner of Lehman's Hardware.
My dad started the store in 1955, and we started out as a hardware store. We focused on serving the Amish, and in the transition from serving the Amish to serving the rest of the world, we struggled with our identity as a company named Lehman's, which is spelled the same way as Lehman Brothers in New York City that went bankrupt under not great circumstances. Lehman Brothers, they were so confused by our existence as Lehman's.com, I actually had to explain to Lehman Brothers that we were not related to them because their attorney called us and threatened to sue us for trademark infringement. And I'm like, look, we're just a couple people in a country store trying to make a living. We have nothing to do with you guys in New York City. Employees of Lehman Brothers who thought they were emailing other brokers at Lehman Brothers were sending emails to their friend's name at Lehman's.com. And the result was that we got emails from brokers that were talking about the drinking they did last night, about clients. We received confidential emails about client business. It doesn't surprise me that they got in trouble because it seemed like they didn't have their eye on the ball. I don't know much about the stock market, but I think the term is you short the stock. I should have shorted their stock. I would have made a lot of money. After the financial collapse, there was a time there when we couldn't even get our own website to show up because Lehman Brothers was dominating the news. And when you searched for Lehman, you found them instead of finding us. We weren't recession-proof. We maybe were recession-resistant. We carry the kinds of products that people look for when things are bad. But our ability to resist only lasted until about the middle of 2009. And then we started to feel it too. And the reason was that by that time, the crisis was so widespread that it affected everybody. I get ribbing from friends who remember Lehman Brothers, but we're a completely different company with values that are much more traditional and much higher integrity than what they had. To me, they're just a bad memory.
You can see Galen Lehman and hear more of his story in a video we've got on Facebook. We're at Marketplace APM. Lehman, the investment bank, not the hardware store. went under 10 years ago this coming Saturday. A big bank, yes, but by historical definition, literally not too big to fail. That whole idea of too big to fail, we've all come to know during the crisis, right? That some parts of the financial system in this country are just so big and so interconnected that their collapse would put the whole economy at risk. Today, a lot of what was big back then has gotten bigger. Take J.P. Morgan Chase, just for instance. It manages $2.8 trillion. That's more than the gross domestic product of Canada or Italy or Brazil. Just six banks manage more than half the assets in the whole banking industry in this economy. Just six banks manage the equivalent of half the gross domestic product of the entire American economy. So how did we get here? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that one.
There was a time when banks were small and plentiful.
At the all-time peak in the United States in around 1921, 22, there were like 30, 31,000 banks in the United States.
Richard Silla is a financial historian and professor emeritus at NYU. The Great Depression wiped out thousands of banks, but for about 40 years after that, the number was stable. Until it wasn't.
There's been a tremendous amount of consolidation during the last four decades, and the American banking system went from about 13 or 14,000 commercial banks four decades ago down to closer to 5,000 now.
Now, one reason there were so many banks is because state laws ensured there were. Federal law left the regulation of bank branches up to states. Different states had different rules, and rules within states could be pretty restrictive.
For most of American history, banks were not able to cross state lines.
Frederick Mishkin is professor of banking and financial institutions at Columbia Business School.
In some states, indeed, you could only have one branch, and you could not have a second branch in that state.
He says some banks lobbied for it to be this way.
This actually was a way for banks to not be as competitive. And particularly if you're a bank in one state, you don't want to have people from other states come in and take away some of your business. So you'll fight like hell to keep them out.
Now, just because there were a lot of banks back in the 70s and 80s does not mean that they were good banks.
So I remember I lived in Chicago in the 1980s, and the service was just horrendous because the competition was just terrible. In fact, I at one point had a case where they had a check that was forged. They cashed it, and they're supposed to give me the money back. I never got it back. So it was a different world.
But the real problem for banks of that era was that because they were small, they were also fragile. Robert Hendershot is associate professor of finance at Santa Clara University and a hedge fund portfolio manager.
Having tens of thousands of tiny little banks is economically insane. It is not an efficient way to organize a banking system.
Today, we talk about banks being too big to fail, but back then, he says, they had the opposite problem.
The U.S. banking industry was too small to thrive.
He points to Texas, where oil was king in the 80s, and which had more banks than any other state.
Oil fell to $10 a barrel, and basically every bank in Texas went out of business.
Regional banks weren't diversified. They were tied to the local economy. Texas, being an oil-heavy economy, was vulnerable, and therefore so were its banks. Hundreds of them failed. The number of banks in the U.S. also shrank during the thrift crisis in the late 80s and the recession in the early 90s.
Not because they were consolidating the way we think about it, but because they were failing.
It's at this point that Congress starts to take notice, and in 1994, it passed the Interstate Banking and Branching Efficiency Act.
And that was where Congress tore down all of the barriers and banks became free to merge and grow across state lines.
And that is exactly what banks did. Through the Great Recession, banks consolidated even further as some failed and were bought up by others. And more banks went from too small to thrive to too big to fail. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Dodd-Frank, of course, is the law that was supposed to take care of that whole too-big-to-fail problem. Technically, the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. David Brancaccio from the Marketplace Morning Report has a couple hours tomorrow with that law's lead authors, former Congressman Barney Frank and former Senator Chris Dodd. Think about what you want David to ask him and tell us on Facebook. Again, we're at Marketplace, APM. Coming up.
I think for a lot of people, the way that they use socialism is maybe just to mean not capitalism.
You keep using that word. I do not think it means what you think it means. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 113 today, 0.4%, ended at 25,971. I get paid for this, right? The NASDAQ gained 48.6%, 79.72. The S&P 500 up 10. 0.3%, 28.87. As Hurricane Florence bears down on the southeast coast of the United States, some of the world's largest insurers in Virginia and the Carolinas turned upward. Berkshire Hathaway banked 0.2%. Axis Capital marched up 0.8%. The Travelers Company inched up 0.1%. Home improvement firms went up. They stand to see a sales bump, obviously, in sales from people making repairs after the storm and preparation before. Home Depot hammered up 1.4% today. Lowe's improved 1.5%. Chipmaker Integrated Device Technology buzzed up 10.6% today. It agreed to be purchased by the Japanese electronics company Renesas in a deal worth more than 6 billion simoleons. Renesas appreciated 4.4% today. Bond prices down. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose 2.98%. You're listening to Marketplace. We heard from Catherine in Bellingham, Washington the other day, who says she finds great value in how Marketplace explains things like tax reform and how changing fiscal policy affects our lives. If you agree with Catherine, please join her by donating online at marketplace.org. And thanks to Catherine and all the Marketplace investors who make our work possible. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Federal agencies are scrambling to coordinate the relief supplies that are going to be needed and in a hurry in the next couple of days as Hurricane Florence comes ashore on the East Coast. This is going to be the first test for the Federal Emergency Management Agency since Irma, Harvey, and Maria of last year, FEMA's response to which was roundly criticized. So Marketplace's Justin Ho looks into how well preparations are going this time around.
Right now, FEMA is rushing generators, cots, and water to military bases in the Carolinas. August Mateys chairs a law firm that represents policyholders affected by hurricanes. He says FEMA has to make sure it sends enough staff to the right locations,
so they can help rescue anyone who's left, and then to disseminate all of the essentials right away.
Those essentials include tarps to cover up damaged roofs and mobile communications vans to help other responders communicate.
And then there's the issue of money being prepared and in place to deliver FEMA aid where that's needed.
Problem is, the agency is still dealing with the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey, Maria, and Irma. A Reuters report from June found that the agency's disaster response force is understaffed by 26%. Louise Comfort at the University of Pittsburgh says FEMA just doesn't have enough funding to respond to Florence.
They will need the resources of business corporations and nonprofit organizations to help out. FEMA cannot do it alone.
Previous hurricanes have taught the private sector how to prepare and respond, says Dale Rogers, a logistics professor at Arizona State University.
Home Depot will have tons of plywood and lumber, and they're very good at responding fast.
FEMA can't move so fast. Roger says it needs more time to plan, especially when the number of natural disasters seems to be multiplying.
What's the right level of capacity you build for? 50 of these? 20 of these? 10? 5? That's a hard question.
In a statement, FEMA Director Brock Long says it takes more than FEMA to respond to storms of this magnitude. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
There's a word out there in the wind as we head into the midterms that is political, yes, but also economic.
And I hate to say it, but our Democratic friends are pushing us towards socialism, which has never worked.
And then if people are going to call me a socialist for believing in those things, like, all right, call me a socialist. Like, I don't give a damn.
And they want to raid Medicare to pay for socialism.
Republican Senator Orrin Hatch to start, Democratic candidate Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in the middle, of course, President Trump at the end there. Socialism is getting a whole lot of play these days, and as you heard, it means different things to different people, which is why we asked Marketplace's Kimberly Adams to take a look behind the slogans and the scare tactics to find out what might be really driving that conversation.
First, we need to go back to the 1950s. The Cold War is in full swing, communism is spreading across Eastern Europe, and in Western Europe, governments are experimenting with socialism. Here at home, government newsreels are warning Americans to be on guard.
The theory of socialism may be exciting to the intellect of many people,
Its glittering promises may seduce the judgment of millions.
But then the warnings went, it was a slippery slope to the real threat, communism.
And so we see the deadly parallels between these two creeds, socialism and communism.
Gallup, the big polling company, asked people at the time how they defined socialism. Frank Newport is now chief editor there.
Back then it was the things that we would have thought of 50 years ago, government ownership of the means of production and equal incomes.
Pretty much a textbook definition of socialism, but intertwined with the threat of communism. But fast forward to a generation with no experience of the Red Scare. Deborah Tannen is a linguistics professor at Georgetown University.
I think young people are just so distant from that, that those negative associations would no longer be taboo.
Today, more than half of young people, 18 to 29, have a positive view of socialism and seem to distinguish economic policies from a political system like communism. That could be because the word so often comes paired with another idea, democracy. Democratic socialism gained a national platform in the run-up to the 2016 presidential election.
Democratic socialism means that in a democratic, civilized society, the wealthiest people and the largest corporations must pay their fair share of taxes.
That was then presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. Georgetown's Tannen says hearing him say that openly in a presidential race.
Most older people thought, this is the kiss of death. If he says he's a socialist, he's dead in the water.
In fact, Sanders made it all the way to the Democratic convention. Now, congressional candidates like New York's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are weaving the ideas of democratic socialism into successful campaign platforms for the midterms. Again, Gallup's Frank Newport.
I think the conventional wisdom now is that they are thinking about such things as Medicare for all, pre-K education guaranteed to all, maybe a guaranteed basic income, quite a distance away from what socialism traditionally has meant.
But here's the thing. Overall, people's feelings about socialism haven't really changed much. When you break things down by political affiliation, more than half of Democrats view socialism positively and have for years. Less than a quarter of Republicans feel the same. What's really changed is the way people feel about capitalism.
I think for a lot of people, the way that they use socialism is maybe just to mean not capitalism.
Benjamin McKean is a political science professor at Ohio State University. He says from the financial crisis to the Occupy Wall Street movement, to big corporate tax cuts, capitalism has become, in some circles, the new villain. In the past 2 years alone, the percentage of Democrats who have a positive view of it has dropped 10 points. And McKean says it's not surprising young people are the most turned off.
So if you're a young person coming out of college, you're seeing most people in an economy that's supposed to be doing great, not doing any better than they were a few years ago, sometimes even doing worse.
But at the moment, capitalism still wins the popularity contest over socialism, with the majority of Americans just fine with the system as it is.
And this is the important lesson. But for now, class dismissed.
In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, hard Brexit edition. The end of the United Kingdom's time in the European Union is nigh, March 29th next, to be precise. So companies are getting ready, specifically getting ready for Brexit without some kind of trade agreement with the EU, the aforementioned hard Brexit. That includes, according to the Times of London, Cadbury, the chocolate people, because the company says the UK is simply not self-sufficient in the necessary Cadbury ingredients. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's up 113 today. That is 0.4%. NASDAQ up 48. That is 0.6%. S&P 500, 10 points to the good, 0.3%. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Tony Wagner, and Joanne Griffith. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. Is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.